Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This time on Vet Story.
And so we'd always talk about having, you know, something. Wouldn't it be great if we could open a bar or something like that? We'd get a proper drink. And he said, look, I'd love to, James, but the problem is I can't get into where you can get into. I can only get it so far. You know, I'll just effectively front you the money until you sell it. Dude, we had anything from Johnny Walker Blue Label, we had the Jack Daniels, we had Jim Beam, we had Absolute Vodka, Smirnoff Vodka in all sorts of flavours. You know, it was jam-packed. I mean, we were passing beer over people's heads. It was kind of one of those kind of crazy scenes. And I certainly always felt incredibly nervous. So I used to carry like an M4 and a Glock, and the M4 was like tucked beneath my seat, and the Glock was like under my leg as I was driving. You know, I personally took a choice that I'm not going to live my life hiding away in a bunker somewhere. And the club motto has always been, it takes real balls to play here.
Welcome to Vet Story. I'm your host, Phil Briggs, and today we're going to meet the guy who founded the Baghdad Country Club.
My name is James Thornett, and I like to call myself Sir, but I'm not knighted in any way. No, I just call myself James Thornett.
James was a bootlegger, a bar owner, but not just any bar. A bar that was built in Baghdad and existed during some of the bloodiest times of that city's history. But before we skip ahead to our tale of gin, whiskey, bourbon, and beer in the middle of Baghdad, tell me about your military service.
I was an officer in the Paras, the British Parachute Regiment. So we crossed the border with two mess down in from Kuwait into southern Iraq during the first sort of operation, which we call Talik 1, in 2003. And then I'd done sort of 8 or 9 years by that stage in the British military, and I was getting to a rank whereby it was going to be a desk job, and that really wasn't what I signed up to do. So I left, and a friend of mine just happened to have a contracting company that won the contract for securing the green zone. So he called me up and said, would I come and run and set up security for the US Embassy in Baghdad? So I did that for 6 months to a year or whatever it was. And then that's when the kind of bootlegging started after that by accident, to be perfectly honest.
And then to mark the time and kind of era you were there, I want to say early 2000s, that would have been in an era we kind of define in the American experience as the surge era, right? I mean, that was kicking indoors. That was really taking the city door to door, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I was running the embassy, it was the end of 2003 coming into 2004. I guess it was kind of spring to summer, April-ish 2004, when the surge really started to kick in, when things started to go slightly sidewards, and then from sidewards to really bad. You know, initially it wasn't like that. You know, you could go downtown in Baghdad without too much trouble. You know, we used to go down and have meals out by the Tigris there in 2003. But then in 2004, that all stopped pretty quickly. And that's when you were getting the Westerners that were kidnapped and beheaded. Then we had the Blackwater incident, you know, in Fallujah. It was becoming impossible almost to live outside the green zone, and even within the green zone, you know, you were getting constantly rocketed and mortared, and there were some of the suicide attacks at checkpoints, and then sort of driving up and down the roads. That was very very difficult at the time, sort of during the surge in 2004-2005 era, because there was a lot of suicide bombings, vehicle-borne IED bombings, that kind of thing, sniper attacks. So yeah, it was in the surge period.
Wow. And the only reason I bring it up is because I think contextually it kind of lays into the next part of this story, which is what makes you kind of half crazy. I mean, during this tumultuous time, you are a booze bootlegger and a bar owner in arguably one of the most dangerous places in the world.
Well, I was, you know, it's not obviously what I set out to do. I didn't enter Baghdad thinking I'm going to bootleg a can of liquor and open this bar.
Right.
But like anything in these kind of environments, things are pretty fluid, and you know, you roll with the punches. And it was, like I say, it was really an accident that this happened. And you know, you could get a drink in Baghdad, just about. I mean, it wasn't fabulous by any stretch of the imagination, and the wine was terrible. But there were some Christian guys still selling liquor from the back of their house. And it was very, very ad hoc.
Okay.
So, you know, there was no bar like you and I would understand as a bar. There were a couple of cafes in the green zone that were, you know, almost tent-like with plastic furniture. You know, you could get a beer or something like that. But there was nothing that you and I would, like I say, would associate with being a bar. And that, so we'd always talked about having, you know, something. Wouldn't it be great if we could open a bar or something like that, or get a proper drink or whatever. You know? And then I was flying in from Dubai into Baghdad, and the transport system, the planes were charter planes, and they weren't very reliable. So the planes to get cancelled at pretty short notice. So we'd been kicking around the airport for like 3 days. And this guy came over to talk to me, this Iraqi guy. And anyway, we ended up chatting. He was a really nice guy, and exchanging sort of what we did to a degree after a while. And he turned out to be the owner of the duty-free rights in Iraq.
Hmm.
And so, you know, that was pretty interesting in itself. I don't often meet somebody that owns the duty-free rights to a country.
Now, it was right about here in our discussion that I was questioning how he actually knew this guy had the rights. I mean, it's not exactly the most stable time in that country's history.
When you say he was allowed to trade, let's put this in perspective. There were no rules as such in Iraq at that time, because there was virtually no government. So some people will tell you alcohol was illegal. Other people will tell you it wasn't. There was actually no sort of, you know, set guideline as to what was legal and what wasn't legal. So we had to start, you know, we kept it under the table as much as we could.
Sure.
But, you know, had there been a government, he has a piece of paper from a government at some stage saying that he owns the rights to the duty free in the country.
Huh.
As and when he's allowed to trade that.
So in kind of a lawless land, he still had some piece of paper with some sort of legitimacy. Amazing.
I kind of asked him how he got that, and he was like, oh, it's a long story, but basically, he used to trade sort of duty-free before the war, and he brought a huge shipment of cigarettes into Baghdad, which the government still owed him for. So he basically camped out at one of the military bases until he eventually got hold of somebody who basically said, well, look, we can't pay you for your consignment, but I can give you the duty-free rights to Iraq. And that's how he got them.
Nice. Anyway, I'm not going to question the guy.
So I say, well, get some decent liquor and get some decent wine down here. And he said, look, I'd love to, James, but the problem is I can't get into where you can get into. I can only get it so far. You know, it's pointless. I need a business partner to do it. Would you partner up with me and do this? So I was like, yeah, sure. And then we took off, but we took off at 5 at night, and Baghdad didn't have landing or runway lights at the time. And, you know, no commercial planes could land at night in Baghdad. So I kind of knew we weren't going to Baghdad. So, and I was the only Westerner on the flight as such, and my security team were waiting in Baghdad for me. So I said to the air hostess, look, you know, look around the plane, look at me. You can see the problem I've got here, and that I know we're not going to Baghdad. So do you want to tell me where we're going? And it ended up being Erbil in the north of Iraq, sort of in the Kurdish-controlled region.
All right, so pause real quick. And a quick search reveals that Erbil is the capital city of the Kurdistan region in Iraq. And while human settlement dates back in Erbil to 5000 BC, it's the history around 2004 that's kind of scary. There was a parallel bomb attack during celebrations in town, killing 109 people in February of 2004. And in the springtime of May 2005, there was another attack, killing 60 civilians and injuring 150 more outside a police recruiting center. Officially, the Erbil International Airport didn't even open until 2005. And so there James is, sitting on a plane where he's the only Westerner surrounded by Iraqis, descending and landing in the war-ravaged territory of northern Iraq.
Now, the guy I was talking to, Ahmed, was Kurdish himself, so, you know, he kind of leaned over, we sat next to each other, said, listen, don't worry, my father's very close to the president of Kurdistan, I'll get you sorted out. Now, I was like, yeah, of course he is. But to be fair, Kurdistan was nowhere near as bad. You know, Erbil was nothing like Baghdad. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't as worried as I would have been if, you know, we'd have been going somewhere else. But still, I didn't know anybody in Erbil. I didn't even know if there was a hotel up there, to be honest, because I'd never been. But to be fair to Ahmed, as soon as we landed, he got his phone out and he made a couple of calls, and we had sort of two armored vehicles on the pan there to pick us up at the as we debussed the plane, and he took me to a hotel, and you know, a nice hotel, and said, look, you go upstairs, have a drink, I'll sort the bill out. You know, now the president knows I'm in town, I kind of got to see him in the morning, but we'll get you to Baghdad, we'll chat later. So yeah, he was exceptionally hospitable to me. He did that in the morning, got me to Baghdad, and you know, that was that for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks maybe. And then out of the blue, he just kind of called me up and said, are you still interested in what we discussed? Which I said, yeah, I mean, absolutely, but I don't know how this is going to work. I mean, how do you want to do this? And he said, look, I'll bring the stuff down, these 40-foot containers full of liquor, you know, full of wine. I'll get them into Baghdad, sort of compound, his compound at the edge of Baghdad. You know, you come up, we'll exchange the containers, you take the containers down. You know, you sell your stuff in the green zone, and I'll sell my stuff at the airport. And as long as we agree not to compete on price, you know, I'll just effectively front you the money until you sell it. So,
what an incredible gift!
Exactly. So I was like, "Are you sure? Because you don't really know me, and that's an awful lot of money you're risking." And he was like, "Yeah, listen, I trust you. You know, what are you going to do?"
Huh. All right. I mean, I guess he's got a point, even though his point is scary as hell. How did he get his hands on the liquor?
Yeah, he had a contract with Diageo, one of the biggest alcohol suppliers in the world.
Oh, indeed. I recognize the name. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this stuff would come from wherever, all over, congregate in Turkey, on the border there, get driven through the border, you know, to into northern Iraq and then down towards Baghdad.
Wow. So these were actual, these weren't just bootlegged versions of homemade vodka in a mason jar.
These were actual brands of... Genuine. The vast majority of it was liquor and wine, because obviously that was the high-priced items. And it was easier to transport that, because obviously the size of cases of beer. Mm-hmm. You could still buy beer downtown in Baghdad if you knew the right guys. There were some warehouses that still had beer. The problem was that they were owned, the vast majority of them were owned by the Christian Iraqis, because the militias were becoming so strong in Baghdad, particularly at the time, certainly around Sardis City and that kind of area. A lot of the guys that were, you know, had been alcohol sort of distributors were being killed. So they were all kind of closing down. There was, you know, two or three of them left.
All right, let's just pause and get our head around this for 1 second. Everybody else in the liquor game is getting killed.
Distributors were being killed.
And James decides to get a shipment of high-end, high-priced brand-name liquors and get into the bootlegging game.
And we'd smuggle it through from wherever he was into the club.
Mm. This guy has huge balls, right?
Dude, we had what? So anything from Johnny Walker Blue Label, we had green, we had gold, then obviously your blacks and your reds, we had the Jack Daniels, we had Jim Beam, we had Absolute Vodka, Smirnoff Vodka in all sorts of flavors. Any kind of top, I would say top shelf, any kind of recognizable shelf liquor we would have within reach. Bear in mind, we only have 40-foot containers to move this stuff in, and we have to sort of carry, you know, 13, 14 different brands of wine in that as well. So
Right.
We kept to the main brands. Well, it was very good stuff, to be perfectly honest.
Tip of the cap to you for making this all happen. But now, let's pick back up where I interrupted you, pardon me. We've now rendezvoused. We've picked up our lot of booze, our 40-foot container. You've headed back to the green zone. Now, talk to me about what happens next in this story, which inevitably ends with you guys basically running a bar.
Well, the first load came in on this 40-foot container. We had a big rig lined up to take it from the airport down to the green zone, which there's a main road, for those that obviously don't know Baghdad, there's a main road, like a freeway that ran between the green zone and the airport, which was, you know, a safe area within reason as well. And it wasn't particularly long. I mean, it's probably 10 miles maybe, give or take. Probably took me 15 minutes. But the trouble was, it was, at the time, it was a really, really dangerous road, because, like I say, that's where, you know, a lot of the military convoys would drive up, so that's where a lot of the insurgents were trying to hit anybody connected with, you know, the war efforts. So there was a lot of suicide bombs, a lot of IEDs, a lot of vehicle-borne IDs, sniper attacks. that road was it was a hairy road, to say the least, at the time.
To demonstrate just how hairy of a road it is, Google search Route Irish. It's a nickname I read for the highway that runs between Baghdad Airport and the military fortress that is the Green Zone. There you'll find countless videos posted from about 2003 through 2005. They show charred and wrecked vehicles that met their violent end along the stretch of that dusty highway. Watching just a few seconds of these videos, you can feel the anxiety and adrenaline they must have felt. The garbage-strewn median, the holes blasted in the sides of the road, the suspicion of anyone visible or any car visible, the overpass ramps, the dangerous and ominous-looking concrete intersections, watching the heavily armed vehicles pass by, and knowing that during this time there were attacks every day. Makes you wonder how anyone made it through. And gives me a real appreciation for every veteran I meet that did.
The guy that we had driving it didn't have the right badge because they changed it over that day. He was an Iraqi guy. So we ended up driving the rig down from the airport into the checkpoint 12, which was the one thing, you know, closest to the airport road. But checkpoint 12 couldn't take 40-foot containers because they didn't have the scanning equipment. So then we had to kind of back this big rig up, which neither of us knew how to drive. No. And then took it through the back streets of Baghdad, which are narrow to say the least. And the traffic there is, you know, you think traffic is bad in DC at rush hour. I mean, it's nothing compared to Baghdad with no traffic lights and no policemen guiding anything. It's just chaos. So we eventually got it around to checkpoint 18, and they got a scanning machine there. So I went through and the other guys got the container through, and Ahmed, my guy at the airport, said, look, it's going to be 50 tons. You need a 50-ton crane to lift this. And there aren't any 50-ton cranes in the Green Zone, so we used two 20-ton cranes, which, you know, obviously the mass doesn't work out on that. So we've got these two cranes trying to balance this container out, and it's just a bit of a Laurel and Hardy sketch trying to put this thing on the ground. But by hook or by crook, we got it on the ground, and that's when the sort of sales started, Christmas Eve, really.
No way. You're unloading a shipping container with two kind of ad hoc cranes, not even strong enough to do this, and this is all going down Christmas Eve?
It's, you know, time for a Christmas miracle, right?
Jesus would be so happy. That is...
I'm not getting involved in that. I don't know about that. I can't vouch for him, but I was happy.
A Christmas miracle. I love it. Okay, go on.
So you know, before this was all, you know, whilst this was going on, I was speaking to a friend of mine that I knew, and I said, look, this is what I've got. I kind of need somewhere to sell this stuff from. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. So we ended up kind of renting this, I don't know, the closest thing to a shop, but it, you know, it's not like a shop you and I understand as a shop. It was a kind of space that actually had a tiled floor and a little bit of air conditioning, which was like 30 feet by 30 feet vast. So we just threw it all in wholesale, effectively in boxes, and we opened up sort of, I think, the day after Christmas for the sales. And then, you know, because it's quite it's obviously a very small community in the Green Zone, not much is kept a secret. You know, people would poke their head in and find out what was going on, and then the jungle drum started, and, you know, before you know it, you've got a ton of people coming in to buy your merchandise. And that lasted for about, this was sort of early 2004, that lasted for about 6 months, and it was a place that was, it was the only thing, the closest thing to a sort of Western bar, which was like a working man's club or a social club.
Sure, sure.
But the Ministry of the Interior got offended by it and closed it down, said, you know, you can't have Unite here anymore, I'm sorry. So the whole thing disappeared off. And then, you know, when I got this liquor, I was talking to, you know, some of these guys, and I was like, look, I really want to start the Baghdad Country Club again, but I want to start it properly, i.e., you know, we're going to have it every night. It's going to be as good a bar as we would find in America. It's going to have proper food, you know, food that you and I want to eat. You know, as a change, I want a beautiful garden. I wanted it very much like sort of Ritter Casablanca's cafe.
Can I just pause right there? When I told my editors that I was going to talk to you about this story, that's exactly what we thought of. Casablanca, Humphrey Bogart. He's looking at you, kid. You know, we're...
She's great stuff. But, you know, we wanted something that was good, something that people really enjoyed coming to. The whole purpose, the whole point of the country club, and it still exists in this sense now, is that stood for and stands for, you know, the best of what we can get.
Right.
You know, I'm not the richest guy in the world. I can't afford certain drinks, but I'll take the best of what I can afford. you know, the club was kind of the same, but we'll do our best to get you the best of what we can get hold of. And we'll present it in a way that is as good as we can do it, so you feel as comfortable as you can feel. And perhaps, you know, for that short period of time you're in this club, you get away from the troubles of the war for a little bit. But it also acted as a very important area because it was one of the few clubs, well, it wasn't the only club for a start, but it was one of the few places, I was going to say, where anybody, as long as you had a badge to be in the green zone, could come in. So you'd get, you know, Iraqi ministers in there, sitting next to American diplomats, sitting next to, you know, an NGO or the UN or a contractor or a military guy, you know, depending on which military you're from.
As James continued to tell this story, you could see it all kind of unfolding in front of you. And even more interesting, to think of the international diplomacy that may have occurred right there at the bar.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of problems get solved over alcohol, don't they, in certain ways. A lot of things get fixed.
Please, I only wish our governments could actually do so, you know?
Yeah, so anyway, we started selling this stuff wholesale, and then, you know, it went crazy. And the people I was renting the shop from, this was kind of maybe 6 months later, perhaps a little more, they'd lost their contract or whatever, they were leaving country, so they didn't have their villa anymore, this shop was attached to. So there was a villa around the corner of where we were in the green zone, this beautiful corner villa. And, you know, to put this in perspective a little bit, for obviously the people that haven't been there, the green zone was where the Saddam had his government. That's where his palaces were. And, you know, there were some really big, nice old houses in there. But they were all, dilapidated now. And the green zone was becoming incredibly packed because, like I say, living outside in the red zone was becoming increasingly difficult and dangerous. So any kind of Westerner with a contract or military, we were all packed in there. So the price of the villa was, I don't know, for maybe like a 3,000 square foot villa was probably $200,000 rent for the year.
Whoa.
So, you know, but I needed to move. So we went in with, you know, $200,000 in cash and spoke to the owner and said, look, you know, we want it. And he's like, okay. And gave me the keys and walked out literally there and then.
And there was like no permitting? There was no, like, you know, how we would do this in England or in America, where you'd need to present some business plan and you'd have to have plumbing certification and a contractor come out?
No. I mean, we told him what we wanted to do, and he was like, yeah, okay. I mean, as long as when you finish, you turn it back into what it was, he's fine with it. But chances of seeing him again, to be personally honest, with 200,000, he's probably left to go somewhere else.
Right.
And, you know, some guys were making a fortune, absolute fortune, if they owned a house in the green zone. And that wasn't even the most expensive house. I mean, I've heard of people paying $400,000 a month for renting houses. So Age actually was my fix-it guy. You know, he got his crews in. I said, right, we need a kitchen. I want proper bathrooms, because the other thing was bathrooms in Baghdad were not fantastic, to say the least. I said, I want some proper bathrooms. I want a separate female bathroom, and I want a male bathroom. And, you know, I want a marble bar, and I want wood paneling, and I want a garden. I want this beautiful garden. And this, you know, there was this beautiful kind of corner plot, but it was all, you know, literally just dirt. So he got sods of turf in and trees and lights and, yeah. And, you know, it took about 5 months, I think, with another, I don't know, $250,000-$300,000 put into it. But by the end of it, we had this thing. You know, we had this beautiful place. I built a kind of, back to sort of Casablanca, I built this kind of bedroom and office above the entire club, so I could live above the club. And
all right, wait, stop. Guy's got the only bar in a war zone. It's like a little piece of Casablanca paradise with a garden and a marble bar. And he's got a bedroom above it? Now, I'm just saying, I think he was probably at some point in his life the happiest bachelor in the world. All right, but I digress. Go on.
And then it was, I can't remember the exact date. I think it was September sometime, but I could be wrong on that. Some guy, it was Thursday afternoon, and we were, you know, we were as busy as normal on a beautiful kind of, you know, 5 o'clock Thursday night type thing on the start of the weekend. Everybody's in a good mood. And this guy that I know, you know, he knew what I was doing. And he said, look, James, can I nip next door and just have a look at the club and see how you're doing? So I was like, yeah, okay, come on, let's go next door. So we went next door, and he said, do you mind if I have a beer? Yeah, the first one to have a beer. I was like, yeah, come on, why not? So we had a beer, and he called a couple of his friends that were next door, and they came in, and they had a beer. And I mean, I didn't know, you know, before you know it, there's like 20 people in there. And then by 7 o'clock, there was like 400 people in there. And we weren't even, you know, we weren't even set up to open. I didn't even know the price of anything. And there was like a bunch of my friends kicking around as well from, you know, people I served with in the forces that were contracted out there. I was like, look, guys, you know, Rich and Simon and some other guys. Like, guys, get yourself behind the bar. And they're like, well, what are we charging? And I was like, I don't know, just make it up. Yes, I don't really care right now. And yeah, you know, we were passing, you know, it was jam packed. I mean, we were passing beer over people's heads. It was kind of one of those kind of crazy scenes, and chilled beer in bathtubs and stuff because we just couldn't cool it fast enough. And you know, I think by like sort of, you know, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, we ran out of beer. But it, you know, it was a great night. We went on till 2 a.m. till eventually we literally ran out of virtually everything. And I was like, okay, we're shattered. We're closed, guys. Let's get out of here. And that was kind of the opening of the club, really. It was again, not planned in any way, as all of this seems to be, for some reason. But it turned into this kind of, you know, pretty cool, well, really cool club, I guess, in a certain way.
Now we get in the podcast right here with the impromptu opening of the Baghdad Country Club. And on its first night, it sold its entire inventory of beer and almost every drop of liquor they owned. I mean, this story blows away my other favorite bar movie, and that's Tom Cruise in Cocktail. Would this become a movie? I'll wait. We'll get to that in a minute.
Given what we were doing, what we had to work with, and you know, the risks we were taking to do that, because you know, bootlegging liquor down the Route Irish, as the airport road was called. You know, if you'd got caught by the militias or something, or through the back streets of Baghdad, you got caught by the militias, you know, you didn't get a jail time. You know, you got executed by these guys.
Yeah, that was my question, is were you ever scared of the authorities, of whether it was the Baghdad police? I assume that they were our allies, but there could have been factions that hated us for being Westerners. Or were you ever afraid that, like, Al-Qaeda members or, you know, what became ISIS members, were you ever afraid of those guys just rolling in, kind of nondescript, and then all of a sudden, you know, it turns to chaos and anarchy and, sadly, tragedy?
I mean, on the liquor runs themselves, I was, I mean, again, unless you've done it, you don't really understand what Route Irish is like, but as soon as you leave the green zone, you go hot with your weapons. I used to carry like an M4 and a Glock, and the M4 was like tucked beneath my seat, and the Glock was like under my sort of leg as I was driving. I used to wear body armor, obviously, but under like overalls, and I used to have some, you know, grenades and some smoke grenades sort of on my chest and stuff. But yeah, I used to roll kind of nondescript, low profile, as we call it, to try and blend in as best I could. So yeah, I mean, I certainly always felt incredibly nervous getting out of the green zone and hitting Route Irish. But I used to try and do it first thing in the morning before any traffic started in there, before the kind of big military convoy started going up and down. And then firstly, let me just make this clear: the chief of police used to live next door to me for a run, and he was a nice guy. And he was introduced to me by a friend, and you know, said flat out, asked the guy, said, look, this is what I'm planning on doing. Do you have any objections? Is there a law against this or anything? He's like, look, you know, James, as long as I can drink there, I don't mind. And he was joking. He just meant, you know, there's basically no law, James. Nobody's going to pull you up for this on the Iraqi side anyway. So I was like, sweet. Okay, done.
So basically, you know, just the liquor runs were the ones that really raised your blood pressure. Inside the green zone, you felt relatively safe.
I mean, as safe as anybody feels in that kind of environment. I mean, let's, again, put this in perspective. You were being sort of mortared and rocketed quite regularly. But that's, you know, in the lap of the gods as to where that lands kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd often run and take cover, like everybody in the green zone, where the sirens would go off, you'd run, or you'd hear the launch anyway. And so you knew something was inbound. Sirens would go off, you'd run for hard cover. We were in a big sort of concrete building anyway, but you obviously want to get away from glass. So, you know, we'd all run inside for a bit, and then there's a bit of nervous energy, and then it lands, and you're like, okay, and then you go and have a look where it landed and make sure everything was okay. And, you know, that was one of the threats. The other threat is obviously, you know, somebody coming in as a suicide bomb or whatever. I mean, yeah, you're conscious of it, but it's like, you know, it's like anything. You can't live your life being scared of everything. And, you know, I'd been over there 3-4 years by that stage, you know, like a lot of the guys were. And you either, A, get complacent or used to it in a certain way that the threat is always there, but you can't, you know, I personally took a choice that I'm not going to live my life hiding away in a bunker somewhere forever. I mean, you just can't. That's not healthy. So, you know, we used to have, you know, obviously, firstly, the security getting in the green zone. People are searched. You can't just walk into the green zone.
Sure.
Now, you know, were there many suicide attacks at the checkpoints? try to get in. Yeah, of course. But you've got layers of security through that. Then, you know, we also had some guards on the gate that would search everybody before they came in. And, you know, that was one of the reasons, the, you know, particularly the U.S. Embassy weren't overly keen about their people coming. Understandable. I mean, if I was the RSO, I'd probably do the same thing. You know, you don't want people gathered in that kind of environment for somebody to walk in and blow themselves up. And I completely understand that. So I wasn't, you know, he put a circulation, and he was a really nice guy. He came around and sat with me and said, look, I really wish I could recommend the place to everybody, but you know that I can't for obvious reasons. And I was like, yeah, sure. But, you know, they were all grown up as well, you know, but most of them did anyway. I mean, especially when there's alcohol involved, right?
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Okay, so now let me just let's see. Okay, so now we're in business. I would imagine forthcoming weeks were fruitful and prosperous, and everybody, you know, you're the most popular guy in Baghdad at one point in time. I can imagine everyone loves your place, yeah. The Baghdad Country Club in full effect, a wonderful bar with proper bathrooms and everything. This sounds like a success story. Like this should still be running. Like this should be the Hard Rock Cafe. But yet I'm talking to you here in America and we're some years later. So take me to the next chapters now. It's in business. Well, so, and how did it end?
The climate in Baghdad generally was changing over, you know, the times we were there. Like we used the term lawless, but, and I use that sort of tongue in cheek in a way. You know, you couldn't go around shooting people, clearly.
Sure.
But, you know, for if you were being a little bit cheeky, running, you know, bootlegging a bit of alcohol here, there's bigger things in the world to worry about. And, you know, generally speaking, every Westerner saw this as a favor. And even a lot of the Iraqis saw it as a favor. There were some of the militias and some of the insurgencies that clearly would have killed us if they'd have caught us doing this. But, you know, it's not like we were breaking the law in inverted commas by doing this. It was just, the place wasn't really set up for laws in that way. But just the feel of the green zone was changing. It was becoming a lot more regimented. They wanted to make it a much more like a military, a huge military base, effectively, you know, try to impose some regulations in the green zone. Started to be a bit more aggressive about how they did that. You know, there were like parking tickets were being issued and speeding fines. And actually, like, guys, I mean, we're at war here. Surely we've got better things to do than stop people for speeding. But okay, I get, you know, there has to be some. There has to be some authority somewhere. And then generators that were outside were being told that we had to move them inside and trash couldn't be left outside. But anyway, Baghdad was just full of trash. Because there was nowhere to put it. So, you know, so you're getting sort of a lot of aggravation for very minor things. And I don't, you know, to be honest, I don't really know what happened in the end as to why it was closed down. I mean, like anything, you know, a couple of people were, for whatever reason, not particularly happy about the bar being there. And then, you know, I wasn't actually in country at the time when it got closed down. I was in Amman in Jordan. But my bar manager called me up and said, look, you know, boss, we've just been shut down. The Westerners that had working for me, basically, you've got 24 hours to get out of the country because their green zone rights were being revoked. So I got them out of country, and then I ended up smuggling myself back into Baghdad. I said, cool, I always joked that I'm one of the few guys that actually had to smuggle himself into the country.
I don't mean to laugh. That's
you know, all my life was there in the bar. I mean, all my money was there in the bar. All my stock was there in the bar. And we'd just gone heavy on stock because it was, you know, I think it was just like beginning of Ramadan. So we couldn't transport alcohol during Ramadan. So we had to buy like 30 days worth of supply for that, which is huge amounts of booze.
Right.
Huge amounts. So that was all there. All my clothes were there and all my personal sort of effects were there. So I had to kind of come in and try and get some of that out. So I managed to get a little bit of it out, but, you know, I couldn't get in the club to move the alcohol or get the cash out or anything like that.
Now, let's just think about that for a second. The Baghdad Country Club's era inside the green zone is coming to an end. And his life's work is locked up inside of a building he can't even get to. What? All his money? All his booze? You got to be pissed off about that.
I mean, when people say to me, you know, were you mad that it got closed down? And I sort of say, you know, at the time I probably was. But in hindsight, I think it's probably the best thing that could have happened because the green zone and all of Iraq was going to change at that stage. And it was, I could feel it coming anyway. And, you know, some of the guys that I was working with weren't, you know, they couldn't really see it. So they were, let's buy some TVs, let's buy ovens, let's, you know, buy pizza ovens, let's do this. I was like, you know what, guys, no more spending on CapEx. Something's going to change here. I'm feeling it. And if it wasn't, you know, for being shut down by these, you know, sort of police in the green zone, it was going to be the Iraqis at some stage because when the elections happened again, or you know, when the government that was elected in 2005 started to get some strength within itself, they were starting to flex their muscles a lot more. And it was a Shia government that came in that were very sort of anti-alcohol. So they were going to start to ban alcohol anyway from the Green Zone. And much as I don't mind doing a bit of bootlegging here and there, I didn't want to do it completely speakeasy. I would not have gone away with it, I mean, in the bottom line.
And you certainly wouldn't have wanted to spend, you know, a better part of your life in some kind of Iraqi prison either, you know, with the new administration coming in there.
No, that wasn't on my list of things to do that year. But these were my friends. I didn't want to offend anybody particularly. I was about doing. I mean, and it run its course. And, you know, I suppose it's a bit like James Dean, isn't it? You know, had he gone on to be 80 years old, he probably wouldn't have been as famous as he was, given what happened to him at his young age. And I think the same is true of the club in many ways. Had it gone on and on and on, it would have just fizzled out anyway. But because it kind of, you know, was closed down and died in its heyday, still has some sort of kind of gravitas around it, an intrigue.
And so ends the story of the Baghdad Country Club, a bootlegger's paradise, the legend of a proper bar in an improbable location.
Because it is kind of this almost mythical, romantic kind of place that was just it was a bit naughty to be there. It wasn't quite a speakeasy, but it wasn't a fully open bar. It was kind of, you know, full of adventurers and bootleggers and, you know, this concophony of interesting people.
But it can't just end like that. What now? What was next? The start of the next chapters begins with the logo of the Baghdad Country Club.
So the club symbol has always been the cross with a golfer, silhouette of a golfer playing underneath the cross swords of Baghdad, you know, the famous monument in Baghdad. And the club motto has always been, it takes real balls to play here. And obviously that was a tongue-in-cheek thing, playing off the golfer and so on and so forth. So now, as we're moving forward with this charity thing for the Iraq and Afghan Veterans of America, I've been talking to the marketing people about certain aspects of it. And this young, very efficient marketing girl that I got, when she first started, she said, look, I must admit, I didn't understand the link with the cross swords because I didn't actually know what the cross swords were. So when she got to understand what the cross swords were, i.e. the monument in Baghdad, it all kind of started to make sense to her.
It's an amazing story, and there's a new chapter to write, which we're going to get to in just one second. Sidebar, we talk about how it was kind of romantic. Was there some romance kicking down at the old Baghdad Country Club? I'd imagine there probably was.
I wouldn't know if I was too busy being a bar owner. But I'm
bar
sure
owners never I'm get sure. romantic. Oh, you're so right.
I'm sure there was some cross swords there.
Crossed swords. All right, well, that's cool. Talk to me, bring me up to speed now. The reason, actually, for this incredible experience that we've documented here, this journey that you've gone on that I've just recorded, is to talk about a new project that you have, and is it correct to say that we're going to kind of resurrect the Baghdad Country Club, or you have plans to do something like this again as a benefit here stateside?
Yeah. When the club closed down, a friend of mine wanted to do this Fly on the Wall documentary, a producer from LA. And he called me up and said, like, I want to do this. I was like, no, you can't. Anyway, so fast forward, I was living in Dubai. He called me up and said, look, there's a guy called Josh Behrman. He wrote the story called The Great Escape, which is what the film Argo with Ben Affleck is based on. He writes for people like Rolling Stone or Atlantic Magazine. He's a freelance journalist, but at the super high end of freelance journalism. He wants to do this big kind of 4 or 5 page article on you and the club. So we agreed, and, you know, Josh and I became friends, and it took about a year to write this thing. And if you go on the internet now and you Google Baghdad Country of James Thornett or whatever, it comes up with this cartoon, and that cartoon is like a 5-minute kind of snapshot of the story that was done by, I think it's The Atlantic, to promote the article that Josh wrote.
By the way, after this interview, I did Google Baghdad Country Club. I did watch this 4.5-minute video, and it's awesome. The visuals are like pencil sketch drawings of all the different scenes that he's depicted in this podcast. And one of my favorites is he depicted the airport where he first met Ahmed, the guy with the duty-free license. And it shows people sleeping everywhere because the flights are constantly getting canceled.
And flights were often canceled without any indication. And you have to turn out there and just kind of hope.
And when one flight gets canceled, the sign just reads, suck it. Now, the promotional video. The article his friend wrote. It soon takes this story from Baghdad and directs it towards Hollywood.
So Josh was doing a lot of promo stuff during the Oscars with Ben Affleck, because obviously Argo won some awards. And I'm told that he was talking with Ben Affleck and Robert Downey Jr., and they were asking what he'd been writing, and he told them about me. And so Robert Downey Jr. apparently sort of said, I want to buy the rights to that story, and I want to make it through my production team. So that was all going on, and Robert Downey Jr. had been involved. So then I got, you know, a sort of script writer got involved from the Downey Jr., Team Downey side. And so we've been busy kind of writing that, and that's kind of sidebar. So it's always been kind of bubbling over in the background. The country club as a whole, it's never kind of died as such. And then kind of forward, I don't know, probably 6 months ago, a friend of mine was setting up a charity, and the charity was called Sound Off. And it was basically to help soldiers with PTSD. He developed this app whereby you could, you know, log on to this app. It gives you an anonymous number or code or something. And then that links through to a dedicated healthcare professional that stays your dedicated healthcare professional. And the idea being that there's numerous reasons why soldiers don't seek help when they have problems associated with the wars, that they don't want to lose their security clearance. You know, if you call somebody like Samaritans or some of the other helplines, you get one person one day and then another person another day. So there's no continuity. You know, just the sheer paperwork you have to go through, perhaps if you go through the VA or something. There are numerous reasons. And it's not my place to criticize the reasons or any organizations around that. But anyway, that was his idea. That was his concept. And he had a brother in the, as it tragically turned out, he had a brother in the, a brother-in-law, sorry, in the SEAL, one of the SEAL teams that retired, who recently committed suicide as well, based on this. Mm. So that kind of got me thinking, you know, he's a friend of mine. That got me thinking, like, I had this club, we had this logo, we have, you know, everybody's always loved the, you know, the motto, which is it takes real balls to play here, particularly golfers and things. We used to sell a ton of golf balls because, you know, golfers like to walk on the golf course, and it's an interesting talking point. Mm-hmm. Got the club logo on, the Baghdad Country Club, it takes real balls to play here. And then I kind of came up with the campaign phrase of take a round for a hero, sort of obviously tying in a round of golf or a round of drinks or whatever with soldiers taking a round. So I, you know, got a bunch of golf balls printed up and a bunch of like little Mason shot glasses to represent the bootlegging days, again, sort of take a shot for a hero. You know, caps, golf umbrellas, just general apparel that to kind of start to raise some money, you know, for these guys. And so I just reached out to the Iraq and Afghan Veterans of America, just called them and said, look, this is what we want to do, this is how we want to help, and told him the story. And he said, look, I love it, let's definitely work together, you know, we'll form a sponsorship partnership agreement, you know, we'll support you, you support us. Obviously if we donate as part of that agreement to them, they give their support in terms of, you know, publicizing us with their members. We've had a couple of kind of promo fundraising nights. We'll have a lot more of those. We're going to obviously move into like the golfing tournament side of things to support the golf sports and things like that. But, you know, anybody that wants to sort of host an event, because we generate a lot of interest. So if you're a bar, slow between 3 and 6 o'clock on a Saturday, we bring a bunch of people down. We have an event down there. We raise money as part of that. The bar makes money because more people drink in the bar. Everybody kind of wins. Everybody has a good time.
So it sounds to me like every bar can now sort of adopt for a few hours the feeling, the esprit de corps that was the Baghdad Country Club. And, you know, they can generate interest based on your theme, and you can travel your theme all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a pop-up thing, I guess, for the bars.
Right on. So is there going to be a bar again?
Hopefully at some stage in the not-too-distant future when the bandwidth opens up a little bit.
Right,
And we find the right place with the right partners to do it with as well. Because I don't really want to be stood behind, you know, running a bar again at my time of life. It's perfectly feasible. That would be rounding the circle, as it were, to complete where we sort of started from. It's strange how these things kind of come around.
Well, I look forward to actually knowing you now and grabbing a pint with you very soon, because I want to be one of the first people to share in some of this success, whether it's the resurrection of the bar, whether I meet you, you know, just prior to rocking the red carpet and Robert Downey Jr.'s movie that stars your life story. This is just really cool. I want to say I knew you when. it's the coolest booze-related story to come out of war that I've had the privilege to record. So,
well, just no, thank you for taking the time and giving me the opportunity to tell it. I hope you enjoyed it. And you know,
let's end with the website itself. Share with me, how do we find you online?
So it's just www.BaghdadCountryClub.org. O-R-G.
BaghdadCountryClub.org. Awesome. A bootlegger, veteran, a man of many worlds, many continents, and many achievements, but best of all, you're a man of a million stories. I love it.
Absolutely. All right, we'll get together for a bit, too.
And on that note, I say cheers. For Vet Story, I'm Phil Briggs, and I'll talk to you next time at ConnectingVets.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.